Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. I'm Alice Thwaite, and with me today is Matthew Bolton, the Deputy Director of Citizens UK and Legal Organiser for London Citizens. He's recently written a guide on how ordinary people can create social change in their communities called How to Resist, Turn Protest into Power. This is written off the back of his extraordinary work campaigning both for the Living Wage and the Refugee Welcome and Safe Passage campaign. I was pleased and heartened that in the book, Matthew discusses two of the things that the ECC podcast aims to do. We want to generate conversations about our core values and then update these ideas so they are relevant for 2017. That way we can then act on them. And it's wonderful to have him with us today. So welcome, Matthew.
Hi there. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Alice.
Great. So let's just start by talking about, in the book, you kind of use this image of a stick man, which is representing you, where you figure out what you want to take action on. So what really makes you angry? Part of this is writing down your key values. Part of it is also what's important to you and where you spend your time. It would be good to start off by talking about what your key values are. Where's your stick man?
Yeah, so the stick man is a tool that we encourage people to use both on themselves and also on other people that they're trying to work with. And although we do ask questions about values, where we're really trying to get towards is people's interests. And I guess in a way that's trying to encourage people beyond what can be quite kind of broad and maybe bland statements of, oh, well, I believe in equality and I believe in justice and freedom, towards more concrete and specific things that, of course, are the roots of those values, but give us a bit more to work with. So for me, you know, it starts off with, you know, what are the relationships most important to you? And, you know, think about I've got a little 2-year-old son, my wife, my family. It asks about the institutions and places important to you. And, you know, I feel really like I did grow up somewhere and I still live there actually now. I've moved back there recently in Southeast London. And my experience of growing up in that place was absolutely experiencing inequality. But I can, you know, really pin it down to specific schools that I went to. I went to my local comprehensive primary school, got a scholarship to then a private school, and then back to state school for sick form. And I can think of specific people who had really unequal life chances. And so I do absolutely think that we need to tackle inequality, and that's one of the things that drives me in my work. But the stick man is really trying to sort of push people to think about what are the people, stories, experiences, places where those values become real for you, because that's how we can really connect to each other and start working together.
So that's interesting what you said about inequality. So you think about inequality in terms of opportunity. So is that in early stages or in late stages of life? When I think about equality of opportunity, I just think that it can kind of count in so many different aspects of where a person is, and people tend to talk about education. What's your take on that, given that you've had an experience of living?
Yeah, I think in some ways the kind of categorization and separation of those two things, inequality of outcome and inequality of opportunity, let's say, is for me it's become kind of less important, really, if you like, the debate between those things, because I just see them as so connected. You know, the it is exactly because, you know, the families in which children are growing up in, there's such a massive gap between their income and their networks, and, you know, the housing, you know, the schools, that, you know, one generation's inequality in terms of their wealth is the next generation's inequality in terms of their opportunity. So I don't sort of tie myself to you know, believing in one and not the other. I think what matters to me is, you know, making a kind of impact on that. And, you know, the Living Wage campaign is actually about trying to you know, improve pay for people who are on the lowest wages. So if anything, you know, it's trying to tackle the kind of inequality of income aspect. But I actually understand that partly around equality of opportunity as well, because one of the things that happens when you earn the minimum wage is that you're sort of forced to work two jobs or extra shifts, and then you don't have the time to spend with your kids. And that would be including kind of helping them learn and develop. So I just sort of see those things as really entwined. And yeah, what matters, I think, probably more than the debate about that for me is what are we doing about it?
Yeah, that was exactly going to be my question, is about whether or not this talk about values the whole time, about kind of ideology, perhaps stops us from taking action. So do you think that this discussion around core values perhaps is secondary to other factors, which is just like what truly makes you unhappy? What would make you happy? And for a lot of people, that just comes down to, I don't know, health or kind of finance, education. And then you can kind of take steps based on that. Would you agree with that statement, that values are secondary to action, or not?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I'll answer it in a couple of ways. I think firstly that the reason that we're always pushing in terms of campaigning and organising, pushing people from the kind of talking about like the overall problem, whether that's about inequality or it might be about climate change, towards the specific issue. So, you know, can we persuade this bank to pay their cleaners a living wage, or, you know, can we get this community signed up to green energy? The problems, the kind of value statements, you know, we have a phrase where we say problems lead to conferences, whereas issues lead to action. That you can have a big debate about what we really mean by inequality, but you can't really have a debate, I suppose you could, about should this bank pay the living wage. It becomes by pushing it into a specific, that then creates a sort of either or, and it becomes about, yeah, it becomes more about action. But similarly, you know, equally, you know, values, who we are and where we come from and what we think is important, I think are fundamental. And it is important to really think about that and connect with each other about that. And so it's not that there's no place for consideration and discussion on values, but hopefully it's about you know, more, you know, values and where we get them from and our kind of roots and beliefs, and also then moving into action, because we get specific about, okay, well, if those are the values, and then what are the implications of that for some specific decision making.
I'm thinking about a passage in the book as well, where you spoke about when you brought a community together who did have very different values, but also came together over the action. And maybe it's also as well that even when you have the same values, disagree about which action to take, but the action might be the same even if you have different values. So actually, in a way, it's interesting to think about, how useful is it to have these conversations? I know it's the point of the Echo Chamber Club podcast, but it's interesting to think about that.
Yeah, I think that that story is about different communities, including Muslim, Jewish, LGBTQ, women's, who had all experienced hate crime and harassment because of their identities. And the organising process, which was about trying to find unusual allies who've got some common concern. So when we try and bring those groups together, the questions that we're asking is, you know, how have you experienced hate crime? How did you experience it? How did it make you feel? Tell us the story of it. And the story, as people recount those stories of feeling humiliated or feeling scared, or feeling scared for their children, you know, that's a real, such common bonds are formed between people who, perhaps, yeah, if the conversation started off with, you know, can you articulate a kind of a values statement for 21st century Britain or something, you might end up in some more disagreement. I mean, I'm not necessarily, you know, don't necessarily know if you would. I'm sure there are lots of kind of value statements that they would agree on as well. But yeah, the organizing process was getting people to talk about, you know, the time I was in the Tesco and someone shouted at me. And that kind of really like grounded human experience, I think, you know, and the story of it, you know, we really appeals to people in different ways, and I think provokes less debate, and maybe provokes more empathy than a kind of abstract conversation about the values of it.
What I'm thinking though is that perhaps even a value statement could be that I don't want anyone in my community, I mean, it's difficult to say in the world, to feel scared, to feel humiliated, to feel ashamed. And that in itself is a value statement, but it's perhaps couched in more practical terms, rather than, yeah, these words that we talk about the whole time, but have varieties of different meanings. Would you say that could still be a value statement?
I think so. That makes sense to me. Definitely. Yeah, it's a value statement as almost kind of recommendation for the way we are together. But yeah, that is, it's a bit more specific, isn't it, than respect?
Yeah. Respect is a tricky one. We haven't actually spoken about respect at all on the podcast yet. It might be interesting to get someone on doing that. But anyway, my question is, because you've taken a lot of people on this journey of finding issues that they care about, building communities, creating power within these communities, and then leading to action. What is the easiest way for people to start having these conversations? What's the number one bits of advice that you'd give to people who are like, we've thought about what matters to us, now what's the next step?
So I was having this because of written. So this is my, you know, this is my day job. I give a huge amount of myself to Citizens UK and community organising and the different campaigns that we run. And actually, writing the book has kind of got me into conversations about social change, or you know, and values and actions and what this means to people with friends of mine who, you know, maybe they knew what I did, you know, roughly, but most of the time we just, you know, go to the park and hang out. And so a few of them have read the book, and interestingly, you know, have, you know, lots of conversations about, you know, they're upset with some of the way that, you know, some of the way elections have gone, or they're, you know, they really believe in particular sort of causes. And I think that the difference of the kind of one-to-one conversation, which is described in the book, and the kind of method of organizing is it's trying to sort of get people to think of social justice, or get people to think of the causes that they believe in, and really try and bring them home to their own experience, and bring them home to a sphere where they might have some influence on. So, for example, I know a group of friends, you know, women in their early 30s, who have a kind of fairly irregular, but like it exists as a group. They meet together and they talk about kind of women's issues, and they recommend things that they've read and seen that they liked, and so on. And I was saying, well, okay, well, and, you know, trying to apply the method to that group. It's like, well, you know, why? What experiences have people had that have made them angry about that? And kind of sharing them between them, and thinking of what level of action, you know, might they have in common. And, you know, one specific that came out as we were talking about was, well, are their employers, you know, they've all had several years at their different companies and organizations, you know, are they signed up to best practice around gender equality and diversity? And suddenly there's, you know, there's an issue that that, you know, under the bigger banner of, you know, feminism and women's rights, it's like, well, okay, how would you persuade your company to sign up to best practice on gender and diversity?
So it's very much about taking these kind of grand statements and building them down into something that you can have influence on, because you can have influence on your employer, whether or not you work for a large corporation that employs hundreds of thousands of people or a smaller one. And that's the easiest way to take it, presumably, is to figure out what's a small action that I can take that is going to have influence rather than looking at the big picture. One thing I did also want to speak to you about and really did attract my attention is there's a passage in the book, let me just get to it, where you talk about how you persuade people who have power. And you talk about the idea that we tend to think of people who are against us as being completely ignorant, as being stupid, about not really, or just being completely unfair. This kind of push it, what you advocate is to say, actually, no, you've got to treat these people as people who have their own self-interest, right? So they have these ideas that are going to be beneficial for them. Either they want to get elected again, or they want to get a promotion, or they want to look good to their boss or whatever. So talk to me through how you perceive us and them, because also you talk about singling out individuals who then have to make changes. How does this kind of dichotomy, this binary, work in terms of creating social change?
Yeah, so there is definitely a tension in between those two things. So on the one hand, I'm saying that the process of analysing power, figuring out a decision maker, you know, taking the example which is spoken about in the book of Ian Duncan Smith, who you know, until fairly recently was the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. You know, while he was in charge of that department, there were quite significant cuts to child tax credits, and also there were lots of punitive benefit sanctions and so on. So you know, there might be a lot of stuff that you really disagree with, and so and some people would therefore kind of paint this person as you know, just like bad through and through, and you know, there is no kind of good business to be done with them, and there's nothing to kind of appeal to there. And the book describes the way that we engage with the Secretary of State Ian Duncan Smith, and how we understood the not only his kind of financial and political interests, but also a bit about who he was as a person. You know, his Catholic background and some of the experiences he'd had that had kind of shaped his values, and we, you know, positioned the living wage in that way. And some of it was quite tense. You know, we sort of, you know, threatening his reputation if he refused to meet with his cleaners, which is a very reasonable request. And so the personalize and polarize is about, you know, you can't win a living wage in Westminster by saying, you know, government ought to increase pay. You know, the more you can fix it onto, you know, it's this person's responsibility. They are the most, you know, powerful decision maker. It's if the scandal of poverty pay continues, it's their fault. So that's the kind of personalized and polarized bit. And that's really about trying to focus the pressure of your campaign so it can be felt on a particular decision maker. But then the bit about not kind of stereotyping people and sort of demonizing powerful people you don't agree with is to just take a step back and try and look with open eyes about what are the interests and values that this person does live by, and what are the points of connection. And you know, my experience of doing this for, you know, for 12 years is that more often, you know, it's powerful people, be they politicians or business leaders, you know, are exceptionally busy. They are facing very substantial and conflicting pressures, and when you finally get round the table with them, often their perspective on things and their kind of dynamics that they're working under are a lot more understandable than if you're just sort of seeing it from the outside and imagining them to be so out of touch and evil and so on. And so yeah, there is a bit of tension between those things, because you're pinning pressure down on a particular decision maker because you need them to make a decision and change the issue for the better, but equally trying to see them as a real human being, as well as someone who is actually in a position of power with all the real pressures around that.
So I suppose it is just about empathizing with people, but then giving them a very specific action point about what they can or cannot do in a situation and making it very clear to them that, you know, the buck stops with them, that if they make a decision that doesn't work in the interest of their community, then it is their fault. But at the same time, that you recognize the pressures that they have on them, and that you recognize the limits of their job and how they you know, function and struggle in society as well.
Yeah, I think you use the word empathize, and I think there is definitely an aspect of that, you know, the kind of keeping in mind and in the way that you interact with them that they are a human, you know, human beings. But also I would add the word analyze as well as empathize, because it's also, you know, it's the point of the book is how are we going to make social change effectively, and you know that's really then analyzing their self-interest, analyzing their power and your power. So it's a little bit more elaborate, I suppose, than formal, I suppose, than empathy. It's also, you know, who are the people that this person would listen to, you know, what are their concerns, what kind of accountability they have, or what kind of pressure could we bring to bear. So empathize and analyze to make the campaign effective. Yeah.
In many ways, it's just like creating mini businesses and kind of trying to create a sales operation, right? This might be me coming into it with business language here, but a lot of the things that you spoke about in the book reminded me of when I worked in sales for a couple of years, about how you have to reach out to people, you have to show them the different options that are on the table. And it's just interesting that for, you know, maybe the past 20 or so years, we haven't treated social change like a business in terms of creating strategy, creating action points and then having outcomes. Instead, we have been quite wishy-washy around the things that we're looking to achieve. So it's great to have a book like this come out, and hopefully some people start thinking about it a little bit clearer about how they can take action in their own communities. I mean, I, for one, I live in a Tower Hamlets Homes block, and Grenfell affects me deeply because I'm dealing with those kind of things as well. And it made me think about how I can improve my communication with my the people who I live with and who I speak with on a regular basis. But instead of just being annoyed about it, how we can actually do something about it. So, I really enjoyed reading it.
Interesting about the point you make about business, because you know, while there were definitely some you know, real sort of similarities around strategy and so on, there's probably also differences. But the bit that really strikes me is that, you know, business has set itself up with really well resourced training and development and strategy, and you know, you can go and do courses in all different aspects of you know, of marketing and business. And if you think about the kind of what's the equivalent, like, campaign social justice infrastructure, you know, of course there are big charities and there are campaign organizations, but you know, one thing that the book is really trying to say is, like, we need a political education for people. Like, how can you be an effective citizen? And there are some strategies and tactics for that, but like we're kind of missing. I feel like we're really missing this big kind of political education piece for people as citizens, whether that's about, you know, your housing block or at the workplace or you know, whatever the issue is.
Great. To wrap up though, because this is the question that we always ask everyone, the Echo Chamber Club, we do have a podcast, but we're also predominantly a newsletter that we use to challenge liberal and progressive. The liberal progressive metropolitan bubble, I suppose. What are some articles, some books, some ideas that have been particularly challenging for you recently? I can imagine you come up with some great examples because of the work that you do.
So I'm going to go for three books, and one's called the Bible, the second one's called the Quran, and the third one's called the Torah.
And that's excellent.
the reason I'm picking them is because I grew up in a secular metropolitan, I can't remember the other words that you use, but probably most of them, environment. And I first started working for Citizens UK in 2005, and was really, I found it quite difficult because half of the member communities of Citizens UK are faith, church, mosque, synagogue, and others. And, you know, my stereotypes and perceptions of those communities, and indeed their holy books, were that they were out of date, and if anything, unjust, you know, perpetuating, you know, injustices to in various ways. And over the course of the last, you know, a decade plus, you know, both engaging with the books themselves, but also particularly kind of talking to people for whom those are their real values, basis, you know, traditions, and really, you know, wrestling with, well, what actually, you know, there are some really important ideas in here, resisting commodification, the dignity of human beings, and so on, which we've used as the basis for a lot of our campaigns. So when we campaigned against the payday lenders, we kind of used the word usury, which obviously is, you know, is on all those three Abrahamic traditions, you know, the idea that you kind of exploit someone that you had lent money to, and it's be usurious. And so we definitely, our campaign to tackle Wonga and everyone else was definitely helped by the fact we were kind of taking these ancient ideas of justice and dignity and trying to apply them to the modern day.
I'm really pleased you chose those three books. Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with me today, Matthew. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. Yeah.
That was Matthew Bolton of Citizens UK talking with me about creating social change. If you enjoyed that, then please do hit subscribe on your platform of choice, whether that's iTunes or other. And best of all, please leave us a review, preferably 5-star, but I can't control how you feel about the podcast. But yeah, please leave us a 5-star review. Also, say you can contact me at any time. My email address is editor@echochamber.club and my Twitter is @AliceLThwaite. I love to hear your comments and thoughts about the episodes we produce in the newsletters, and I do think I reply to pretty much every email. So yeah, do get in contact. Otherwise, you can find all the Echo Chamber Club content at our website, which is echochamber.club. And yeah, we've got another podcast coming up very soon. I'll be interviewing Dr. Sue Black about her key values, so do tune in next time. See you later.